This week on Writers, Inc.
My optimistic outlook on it is that, you know, we will find ways for people to still be creative and still be able to create things. They'll just be using different tools.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
J.P. Reinflesh.
I almost said I'm Kevin Tomlinson instead of J.P. Reinflesh. I almost said it, but I caught myself. So hello, everybody.
Hello.
J.D.'s not with us this week.
No, he's either in Belgium or Amsterdam or Germany. I forget.
They don't have internets in Belgium.
And that makes sense. I've long suspected that.
It's a different plug.
Those three countries.
Hello, anyone from that location.
Hi, Germany. How you doing? How do you plug stuff in over there?
I don't know.
They got a whole different plug system.
It's a weird plug.
Ours look like little screaming faces.
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
I think that's on purpose.
They're just eyes.
Sometimes they're just eyes. We went with a whole emoji thing for power in the U.S.
Yeah. So. Anything exciting going on? Can we embarrass Jenna on air? It's Jenna's birthday today.
Jenna's birthday. As we're recording.
Like, we're embarrassing you.
So, Jenna, does that mean that you and I are both Libra? Are you a Libra?
No, I am Scorpio. Today I usher in Scorpio season.
Yeah, I don't know what the difference is. I don't know what it means to be either Libra or...
I'm meaner than you are is what it means.
That tracks.
Oh.
Well, suddenly I'm a believer in this stuff.
Kevin is supposed to be the more diplomatic of the two of us.
I am very diplomatic, actually. It may not seem like it to the listening audience, but I am
very Libra of you.
I'm very diplomatic.
I believe it.
I'm duplicitous too. So who else had anything good? Anything good happen this past week or so?
I'm going to get Buntinis today.
Ooh.
Is that alcohol? What is
That's
that?
Alcohol.
What's a Buntini?
Bunt cakes. This place in Vegas they're called Buntinis, and they're basically like little mini bunt cupcakes.
Love them.
What flavor? Yeah. That's amazing.
So we're getting it. You get to pick your variety packets, like vanilla and double chocolate chip, red velvet, white chocolate raspberry, strawberries and cream.
Ooh.
Yeah, a confetti birthday one, hungry. Obviously.
Obviously.
Obviously. I don't know. There's like, an Oreo cookie cake.
Okay.
All the flavors. So you're just
I can't eat
all
any of that
flavors.
Stuff. So enjoy.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah. I try not to eat too much of that delicious carbs and sugar, but it is my birthday. I will be eating the delicious carbs and sugar on this glorious day of my birth.
Do what
International you want. Diabetes Day.
It's also slap your coworker in the face day.
It is. And that should tell you all you need to know about Scorpio season.
I am my only coworker. I've been smacking myself all day. So we're still downsizing. So that's what all my extra time has gone to. But we had our first garage sale of several on Saturday last week.
How'd it go?
Went really well. And I hate doing garage sales here anyway. I used to love doing them when we were in our old house. Because you get these guys, there's, I don't know, maybe every neighborhood has this. You guys tell me if you've ever experienced this. But there's these guys who come around and they have pickup trucks. And they generally what they do is they go around on like trash day and they pick up anything.
Yeah, we have one of those.
So those guys love coming to garage sales back where I came from. Mm-hmm. And because they'd buy Anything, man. As long as they could get a good bargain on yard tools or whatever, they'd buy all the yard tools because they take them to the flea market and resell them. So I had a habit of going around like the evening before trash day and picking up all the stuff that people put out by the curb and then putting it in my garage sale. Like I made like $1,800 one year
That's
by doing
genius. Wow.
that.
That's,
So, pro
yeah.
tip. But here they
Cool.
don't do that stuff. They don't. No one puts anything out, and the people who come by are like, "Oh, this." They for some reason they expect everything to be like retail quality, even though I'm only charging you a dollar for this chair. You want it to be like blemish free, and there's a scratch on the back,
Yeah,
So,
it's a dollar.
dollar. Kara does not understand. She does not get the concept of price to sell. Right. She's hung up on sort of the we paid X. I'm like, you look, if you want to hold on to it, if you want to keep it, then by all means price that thing at $400. But nobody's going to buy that at a garage sale, So now that we're a little further along, we're really committed on this like downsizing minimalist thing now. Like we've gotten rid of the things that I've held on to literally all my life. I've had some of this stuff and so she's finally kind of getting in that same mindset. So last night we sold like this IKEA cabinet thing she'd built. She was real proud of it. She wanted a ton of money for it. And somebody popped up. I was going to repost it for like $100. And somebody just happened to pop up and say, "Hey, I'll give you 250 for it." And so we sold it last night. And she was all on board. 2 weeks ago, she was upset at the very idea of selling it for less than like $500. So
Oh, all
progress.
right. Yeah, that's
Yay.
pretty
She doesn't
nice.
listen to this show, so I can say anything I want.
Yeah.
Well,
Yeah. All right. I guess we better do the news.
we better do the news. Okay, so first up, new report urges publishers to capitalize on hidden strengths. Books get only about 5% of US media time, yet 60% of people want to read more, and most give reading their full attention. To grow, publishers should team up on pro-reading campaigns, lean into reader communities and word of mouth, and sell their own fan merch instead of waiting for TV or film tie-ins. Use AI behind the scenes to cut costs, but spotlight humans up front. Over 70% of readers aren't interested in AI-generated books, so label, quote, human-created stories as a trust signal. I'm 1,000% on board with this entire strategy. This is a very good strategy.
Yeah, I really like the idea of doing your own merch. Like I guess I just didn't even realize that publishers don't do
Yeah,
that.
no, there's a ton they don't do.
Literally wearing my own merch.
Yeah. Me too. It's just underwear.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, I think
Dang.
they do it sometimes, but for the most part, no. It's kind of an interesting thing because I know that there's like a lot of authors that have an interesting balance between like people who make fan merch and those who don't. Like some authors wholly embrace it, right? Because they know like they kind of have to. I mean, I guess they don't have to, but you know, but then you have some people who are very opposed to it and will like go out of their way to like to go after those tiny little shops, which is crazy.
Yeah. Although I do try like to buy it from the author when I'm buying merch versus people who are doing
Yeah.
fan stuff. I
Yeah.
may have bought a Dungeon Crawler Carl shirt
Yeah.
and then seen a million knockoffs in my Insta feed.
Well, that's
That
the real trick though, is
could
like
have
coming up with merch that isn't just junk, right? That
happened.
people actually want to buy and that still represents you as a brand and as a your books as a product. I would love to do like there was a craze there for a minute where people were using AI to generate action figures for their stories and stuff. I'm like, that's cool and all, but I want the real thing. I want to be able to offer like a Dan Cotler action figure. Actually, I want to offer a Kevin Tomlinson action figure.
I mean, I'm sure it's pretty smart though, if you are an author out there in the world, whether traditional or indie, and you know, we all have seen shops and stuff that we like. You know, I'm sure if you reached out and worked with them, like it's kind of the best of both worlds, right?
Yeah.
Like you get to direct people to them, they get to create
Right.
what you can't, and you can kind of And then you have a little bit of say in the design and things like
Yeah.
that. Like, I think that's actually really smart to do. I love
I'm
fan merch, like especially t-shirts. Like, I'll wear those.
right. I'm a little immersed into like direct sales on TikTok, and because I kind of started with more artsy stuff and then moved into writing, I did a lot of like some merch to begin with, but now like I hire for stickers and for bookmarks and all these things, and like on TikTok, and you know, when you can get them to your direct sales site, like people will eat that up if they can get a book and you can add in like a sticker or something, and then even have as on like any direct sales thing, the art packs or the sticker pack add-ons or like anything like that. I have somebody right now who's working on tea blends for some of my characters, and then I'm just gonna, you know, add that in. It's just so, for me, this is sort of like a secondary thing because, or like, you know, that thing that I just immediately think about. The shirt I'm wearing right now says the Owlet Cafe, which is a cafe that is in one of my books. And I just was like, obviously, I'm going to make a shirt. And then people ask people when they wear it, like, oh, where's that place? That looks like a fun thing. And they're like, it's not a real place. It's in a book. And then
Okay, be
surprise.
honest. Be honest. Does anybody ask you that? Has anybody asked you?
No one's asked me that, but I've heard people who have bought the shirts who have been asked that.
So I am partnering with a good friend of mine who has a coffee roaster business in Sugar Land, Texas, and I'm white labeling some of his coffee under my. So I have the whole Novelton brand, and my what I'm going to do is write a story for each type of coffee. There's going to be a little vignette that goes on the outside of the packaging, so that
That's
people will
fun.
want to
That's
buy
cool.
each bag.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, I think stuff like that is really interesting, and especially if you want to like help with early buzz, like those influencer boxes, and you create, find the Bookstagrammers that are the TikTokers that you like and put together, stickers and, just things. People go crazy over that stuff. They love it.
Oh yeah. When I was a
I'm just
teacher, man,
curious.
I could have gotten a kid to gnaw off his own arm for a sticker.
But so you guys are doing your own merch, but what do you think about publishers doing the merch?
I think they should do it.
Yeah.
So it depends. Some publishers are better than others. I will say Entangled did when the Crave series came out, they did a whole line. One of my favorite shirts, and I don't even know why it came out with the Crave merch because it's not actually like, but it says antisocial influencer. You've seen me wear it. I love it. It's my favorite shirt. I get compliments every time I wear it. Came from Entangled. The book doesn't have anything to do with, I guess a bit antisocial, but no influencers. But it's, you buy it and then, you want to see what else they come up with. And then, you might buy another, like I bought a couple shirts from there. Some were more book related than others, but I think they should do it.
Yeah, I agree.
So if it was your merch, JP, because you also have a traditional, you have an agent and stuff. If they were putting out your merch and taking a cut of that, that would be good with you.
If the deal was good, yeah.
Perfect.
Right? Like
Yeah, that's what
at
it's
the end of
always
the day, if
about,
the deal's good, I'll take it. But
right?
yeah.
Cool.
Especially if it encourages more book sales, that would be great.
100%.
All right, next up, Amazon algorithm change has led to volatility and visibility, warn indie authors. Indie and digital first authors say Amazon's newer algorithm has made book visibility and bestseller ranks jumpy, favoring steady reader engagement and outside traffic over short, spiky launch promos. Some report faster rank slide-offs even when sales stay solid. Allies advice, diversify beyond one retailer, keep metadata sharp, build direct reader relationships, and lean on series read-through and consistent touch points. Small presses are also eyeing bookshop.org's new ebook option in indie stores for curated online reach. Amazon says bestseller ranks now update at least daily, and that nothing else in the sales ranking formula has changed, with recent activity still weighted most. It's funny. It's funny. This reads like exactly the advice I've been giving indie authors for like the past 10 years.
Have you noticed, those of you that are indie, any changes in your sales? Like in the rankings when you're
Yeah, I have. I, 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 But to me, it didn't come as any sort of panic or shock because it's the same thing I've seen over and over with Amazon. Like they make some tweak to the algorithm and suddenly it's Armageddon for the books for 90 days or however long it takes them to change it to something else or change it back.
Yeah.
I feel like that happens on every algorithm.
Yeah, but I don't think steady sales is necessarily bad. Like, that's kind of what we've wanted all along. Like, this don't push for promo and just care about those first 2 weeks.
Yeah, I actually do a lot less of the big bang promos on launch than I used to do. I mean, I used to make a huge deal of a launch, and now I make a huge deal to my curated list of readers, and then I don't try to, blow it out beyond that because I've got enough readers on my mailing list that this is kind of a cheat, really. But I mean, they're gonna buy that book, and it's gonna rise up in the ranks. I don't have to go spend a bunch of money and time promoting outside of that because, in the past anyway, Amazon, once it reaches a certain point, a certain critical mass, will promote that book to people within its own platform, at least for a day or two. It used to be like, I could count on a halo for like 90 days, and now it's like, 90 minutes. But as long as my readers are finding and buying it, it's fine. And then you get a nice sort of steady trickle. So my aim in life is to just create as many of those steady trickles as I can.
Yeah, same. Yeah, I don't really invest in like the big launch promo pushes now. I've just been really trying to be more social media first and everything, and just being present daily and doing something. And that has led to like the steady trickle. So
Yeah.
it's been, for me, it's been nice because I don't really see those like huge jumps in rankings. It's just a steady, I don't see a huge dip in rankings either. It's just the same. And
Do you
then,
do something every day? Or
I
okay.
post at least 3 times a day.
Yeah. And you've been doing that for like over 2 years, right?
Give
Yeah.
us an example. What sorts of things do you do every day?
So I do my main one is TikTok. So I'll do TikTok videos every day. They're about 6 seconds. I don't try to do anything big. I don't try to do anything bright or anything. This morning, I think I had like a picture of myself, and I had words over top. It said, POV, you're in search of a cozy queer fantasy. It's me, it's music. I hold up the book, I smile, end of video.
All right.
I love it.
It's
I'm going
super
to steal
easy.
that exact formula. I'm
Please
going to do
do.
that
That's the whole
tomorrow.
point. And like there are plenty of other things like that. There are some that take a little more time. There's like if you are on TikTok and you don't have to be for hours on end, but if you just flip through it a little bit, you can see what music is trending that day and you can grab it. There's this like remix of Everything Is Romantic or whatever that is really popular. And so there's a way to do it where you can throw in like 22 pictures. And I have a ton of artwork from Moss at Apothecary. And I was able to make a video off of that pretty quickly. So again, it's just sort of figuring it out. Maybe if you can make a little plan for the week, when I have a plan for the week, it makes it way easier. But then I use the same thing for every other platform. I'm not trying to make
Yeah.
60 different things. I'm posting the exact same thing everywhere I can.
I'm going to shoot a 2-hour movie and I'm only going to share it 6 seconds at a time, 3 times a day on
It
TikTok.
could work. You never know.
Perfect.
Follow your dreams.
Follow
You
your
could stitch it
dreams.
together too, and then people would have to like flow and watch it.
Yeah, there
Very
you go.
cool. Yeah.
You could put it as a playlist.
All right. Well, final story. Gen Z wants more animation and less sex on screen, according to Teens and Screen Survey. Gen Z is leaning into animation and shared movie going. Nearly 49% prefer animation over live action, and go see a new movie in theaters is their top weekend pick if cost isn't an issue. They also say that they watch more films and TV than older generations assume. They still watch differently. About 80% sometimes or often view shows and movies via YouTube or TikTok, yet 53% talk more with friends about movies and TV than about social media content. What they want on screen is relatability and friendship-first stories. Around 60% want romances that center friendship rather than sex. Nearly 60% want more friendship-driven plots, and 48% think there's too much sexual content. Love triangles and toxic relationships are turnoffs. It's like, I grew up in a Baptist church. This is what this feels like. Feels
I
like we're
just
returning.
this is a little bit different. Actually, I'm all for this. I have long said I think a lot of traditional romance tropes are pretty toxic. Like, and if you were to take that in the real world, like no one would be like, "Oh, you should totally stay and take that, borderline emotional abuse from that man." Like, nobody would say that. So I'm glad that they're doing that. Good for them.
I'm
I am
just
too,
wondering how
actually.
this is going to translate to books. I think it will. I think we're already seeing kind of more of that with Gen Z wanting more friendship stories and less.
So, can I say, okay, I have noticed lately that when my books are discovered by that crowd, which will, I guess we'll label Gen Z. I mean, I don't really even know what the lines are, honestly, but so like all my audience has traditionally been much older women, retirees and that sort of thing, who enjoy my stories because there's action, but there's not a lot of violence and there's no sexual content or language or whatever. And but I have noticed that I'm getting emails and DMs from a much younger, mostly male crowd now.
See, it swings. I think when we get Gen Alpha, because I see them, because I work in schools, I think it'll swing back the other way with Gen Alpha.
That's
Those
right.
maniacs. And books I think are a little bit different than like movies and TV. But yeah, I think like, it sort of got, and I'm sure romanticism sort of is encouraging this in a lot of new releases, but where it's like, no matter what the story is, you have to put a sex scene in, you have to put a romantic subplot. And I like a nice romantic subplot because I do think it's an opportunity to explore some emotional depth, particularly in like an action or like an epic fantasy where, emotions aren't exactly top of the plot.
It was a little interesting. I watched this video earlier today, Sarah Michelle Gellar talking about her return as Buffy and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And the question was like, why do you think like now is the right time to come back to this? And it wasn't, the high action or anything. She talked about like now people are really looking again for that found family and for that like
That's
vibe. And
right.
I think that like found family doesn't mean that it has to be happy-go-lucky cozy. It can be a Buffy the Vampire Slayer type show, and you can still find that. But I think that like that's what people are sort of looking for is that connection. And a lot of that was lost, especially, when COVID had started with this disconnect. And so people are looking for ways to connect and to feel that connection, and they still are. So I think that that's why this is such a rise.
I agree.
I agree with all that. I think it's good. Good for the kids.
Good.
Feed
We
all
like
that
it. Good job,
good
kids.
wholesome storytelling that you can share with literally anyone in the family. That's what you that's what we're looking for.
This is some light vampire killing.
Romance should not always focus on the physical. And I
Agree.
think like that's sort of always kind of been my problem is like just because you have good chemistry with someone doesn't mean that you should like pursue that person. And so if they're going to force people to, look at the more complex nature of romance, I'm all for it.
I
Beautiful.
guess. You have a story. Share it with the world. Ingram Spark offers everything you need to publish, promote, sell, and print your book. Reach millions of readers worldwide with powerful tools created for independent authors. Get started for free at ingramspark.com/learn more.
All right. So up this week, it's Eduardo Ballerini. Eduardo is an award-winning narrator of audiobooks, a familiar face on screens from The Sopranos to the recent A Murder at the End of the World. So here he is, Eduardo Ballerini.
I am really piqued. I'm interested in this topic because as we record this, I am actually in New Orleans, and I've already talked to a handful of vendors and people who are doing audiobooks, and they're doing AI audiobooks as well as bringing in human narrators. So we got the perfect guest to talk about that, Eduardo Bellarini. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, man. I'm excited to talk about this. I've definitely got some thoughts about the whole AI phenomenon.
I want to hear them. And it could be I don't know, it can be controversial. Are your thoughts controversial? Are we gonna
I suppose my thoughts might be controversial from the actor's standpoint in that I'm not totally opposed to AI
Oh,
stuff.
okay. Well, we'll get to
So,
that then.
yeah.
Let's first thing I want to do is like, because you've got a pretty eclectic background, beyond just doing audio work, you're an actor as well. Like you've been in some, you were in The Sopranos. I
I
recognize you
was.
from The Sopranos.
Yeah.
What are some of the other things
Oh,
you've
God, there's a
done?
lot of shows. Sopranos, Boardwalk Empire, 24. The most recent one was the Hulu series, A Murder at the End of the World, where I actually play an AI. So my world's collided on
It's all
that
coming
one.
around.
Yeah.
That's cool. How so? What was the what caused the transition? Not a transition, I guess, because you still do both. But
Yeah.
how did you end up kind of crossing over into doing audiobooks?
So yeah, so I, was a film and TV actor for a number of years, and then right around, I guess, the late 2000s, when audiobooks started kind of becoming a thing, that's when Audible was launched. There seemed to be this kind of big search for actors who might be interested in this kind of work. It was kind of new. I mean, obviously, recorded books have existed for a long time, ever since, phonographs. But suddenly there was this explosion, there was this need, and quite simply, a woman in LA asked me if I'd be interested in doing it. And I said, sure, let's give this a shot. Why not? I have a literary background. My parents are both professors. My father's a poet. My mother writes as well. And I was like, oh, this is an interesting marriage of acting and literature. So, let's give this a shot. And I found, quite frankly, that I really enjoyed it. It felt very comfortable to me to be in the booth with a book, lending my acting talents to novels and nonfiction. And it just kind of worked out very nicely. And from there, it kind of took off, and it kind of took me by surprise. I wasn't really expecting it, but all of a sudden, I was getting a lot of offers. I was winning some awards in the industry. It took off without my really knowing how or why, but I'm very glad it did.
How is the process different? I mean, when you're acting, you want to be off book, right? You want to be able
Sure.
to memorize the script and be able
Sure.
to go in and do that cold. And
Yeah.
when it's a very different story. I don't imagine you're trying to memorize an entire novel.
You're not memorizing an entire book, definitely not. So yeah, I mean, in audiobooks, as you can understand, you're playing all the parts, but what I really try to think of it as is you're really playing the part of the writer, right? So in a sense, there is that single voice because a book was, I mean, there are co-author situations, but generally speaking, a book was written by one person. And so it all came out of this one mind. And so you kind of, as the actor, have to kind of get into that side of it, like who is this author? What is their voice? What is their style? And then you can dig into the, all right, who's this character? What's this character? How are we going to play this? But my primary objective is to think about the voice of the author and be that voice.
That's interesting because I don't think I've ever heard anyone discuss that before. In terms, because you think first of the characters. You think basically you think of the dialogue,
Sure.
and
Right.
you almost forget about the parts in between.
Right.
So, like, what's the process there? Like, how do you? Like, how does the author's voice influence how you're going to narrate the book?
Well, every book, as you understand, has a perspective and it has a storytelling voice behind it. And so, quite literally, what I'll do is before I start recording is I'll get a book. If I'm offered a book, I'll read the first 5 pages aloud, just, not recording it. And I just kind of want to hear what this writer sounds like. And that's studying their sentence structure. That's studying, are they into metaphors and similes? Are they kind of, they have long sentences, they have short sentences? What kind of vocabulary are they using? Is this a very intellectual kind of book, or, is it more like street level kind of writing? And so I really just want to study that before I get into it. And then, as you say, the characters are kind of the juicy parts, right? And so the actor is like, oh yeah, I get to, here comes the killer, let me give the killer a great voice. But for me, it's that bigger picture first.
How do you keep all the characters straight when you're doing
That's a
that?
fantastic question. So what I learned early on was a little trick, which I sort of think of as like I'm casting the parts in my head. So, and I'm not doing impersonations necessarily, but it's just a way for me to kind of keep track of who these characters are. So,
If a middle-aged guy comes along, I'll think, okay, let me maybe there's some middle-aged actor, and I can think of that person, and then that'll be who I refer to in my head. Or it could be a friend of mine. It could be somebody I know, and I'll think, all right, their sort of rhythm and sound is who I'm going to use for this character. And I'll make some notes. I'll say, okay, this character is this person in my head, and that way I get to kind of keep it organized in my head. Otherwise, it would be chaos, because a book can have many, many characters.
I was the first thing that came to mind. Like, I have a couple of books that have like an ensemble cast. I just can't imagine trying to, make sure I'm differentiating each voice individually.
It gets tricky, and sometimes you get those scenes where you have like 10 characters speaking. And as the narrator, as the actor, I'm always thinking, oh my God, like, how am I going to differentiate these 10 people speaking in a room? And that trick of casting it has worked very well for me.
That's good. Yeah. So what are what are some of the challenges? Because you mentioned like some people use lengthy sentences, some people use extensive vocabularies. Like, what are the things that tend to cause you to stumble and then you have to kind of take more time with?
Well, I'll tell you something. I'll be perfectly blunt. The better written the book is, the easier it is to narrate it. So when you come across a writer, and I'm not going to name any names, who,
Go
you know,
ahead. Go
no, we're not doing that.
ahead.
Who suddenly are like, they're giving a character description which doesn't match how they introduce the character, for example, that gets really tricky. And that is, to my mind, kind of sloppy writing, or maybe an editor was not involved as deeply as they should have been. That becomes tricky, because then you, as the narrator, aren't quite sure what to do, right? You're like, well, this character was described as wimpy in chapter one, and now suddenly they're described as being like really, that their underlying characteristic is this sort of aggressive thing, and it's like, well, this doesn't jibe. And I get the characters can change. But, when you're talking about like what underpins a character, that gets tricky for me.
That's interesting because I mean that's it almost makes it like I would almost want to hand you the book then, even during the editing process. Although that would be like, extra work for you, but it's like, that's and people have made the argument that writers should read their work aloud while
Yes,
editing. Yeah.
absolutely. I had a professor in college who, when I was in an undergrad in college, I wanted to be a writer myself, and I would bring him my stuff, and one day he said to me, "No, you should really read your stuff aloud." And I thought, okay, he didn't mean it for any professional purposes. He's just like, so you can hear it. So I went back to my dorm and I started reading my short stories and my little fiction aloud, and it really changed everything for me. And I think that was possibly where the seed was sort of planted in my head. This idea of narration.
What sort of things do you pick up on? Like, I was given advice and I don't follow it, unfortunately, but to vary the sort of attributions that I use, because I use a lot of, Stephen King kind of got me my head in the game of use he said and she said, because that's you don't need much more than that. Don't get too fancy. But when it comes to the narration, it gets really repetitive. So
It's a funny thing. I've heard this before, that like the he said, she said is almost extraneous when it comes to narration. If you have a narrator who's doing their job, then you really should know when a different character is speaking, right? But obviously, what we are doing is taking something in print and just reading everything. We're not here to edit it. And that actually brings up another point, which I wanted to say, is that the narrator's job is really in service to the writer, much more so than I would say, compared to a screenplay or a stage play, even, where it's almost expected that the actor is going to make some choices which aren't necessarily written there. And sort of that is what becomes exciting sometimes, right? An actor makes a choice which nobody expected, and it's different, and it wasn't there in the screenplay or the play. But in narration, you're really beholden to what is in front of you, right? And so, for example, if you get an attribution, he screamed, you're kind of obligated to scream the line, to a point. Whereas in a screenplay, let's say, you might say, you know what? I think my character wouldn't scream here. And a director might say, oh, that's a really bold choice. Let's go with that. But you don't do that in narration.
Have you ever had an author just kind of give you carte blanche to just make those decisions? Make those
No, the
choices.
only, you know, the only experience I had, and this was really fascinating. So Jess Walter, the author, and I collaborated on a
Okay.
piece. It was an Audible original called The Angel of Rome. And so it was based on a story from my life. And Jess thought it was a really fascinating tale. And he was like, this would make a great story. Do you want to work on it together? And I said, sure. And so Jess came to New York and we got together for like a week. And he would write and then we would get together and I would read. And so we were kind of workshopping it as we went
Yeah.
along. And that was fascinating because then we started to mold the characters together and we started to mold the action together. And so that was really the only time when it was like side by side with an author creating something.
Yeah.
But it was a very different process than any other.
That's actually kind of fascinating. I would go in for something like that,
Yeah, and
just
Jess now says, "Oh, I wish I had you just, to read all my stuff as I'm working on my novels and stuff." I was like,
Did you
"Well,
get like a co-author credit for
I did,
that? Is that that's
I
pretty
am
cool.
the co-author of that one, yeah."
That had to be a ton of work though. Like that's got to be a lot more work than either of you would have been used to with a
Yeah,
single
well,
book.
I mean, to be fair, it was a 20,000-word piece, so
Okay.
it's a shorter piece.
Still, 20,000 words is nothing to
Yeah,
sneeze at when you're,
it's a
you
Couple of hours in
know.
audio.
Yeah,
But
that's
no, it came out really well. And as I say, the story was based on something from my life, so it was even more special for me that way.
Yeah. Well, let's get to your promised super controversial take on on AI.
Right.
Because AI is here. We're not getting rid of it. It's not
Yep.
going away.
Yep.
And I confess I've used AI audio for some of my stuff. I've
Sure.
narrated some things myself, but hard for me to say what I prefer. It's definitely easier and cheaper for me to use AI, but not always the best choice. But I want to hear what you were, kind of getting to, because you're not necessarily opposed to it, you said.
No, so obviously, as an actor, I'm very protective of anything that is taking work away from
Yeah.
actors.
Yeah.
And so let's start with that. At the same time, I think, well, two things. One is that when a technology becomes available, you can't really expect an industry just not to use it, right? It'd be like saying to the filmmakers out there, well, we know that you can shoot digital film, but we insist you shoot, Kodak film stock.
Right.
It's like, well, this is here, so let's figure out a way to use it. The place where I think AI voices are useful, well, first of all, it gives you the ability to put anything into audio right away,
Right.
right? So let's talk about like news articles, which has become a big thing. To hire, 10,000 actors to record every article is kind of, logistically impossible. And yet, as a news publication, you might want these things available. And this is an area where, the performance aspect of it isn't necessarily as important, right? You're just delivering information. And so I'm not completely opposed to some publications saying, if you press this button, you can listen to our article. There are many people that need that. And you might also reach a larger audience that way. The second, I will say that when it comes to performative stuff, like a novel with characters, AI voices are not great.
Right.
They just they can't do it. They can't really differentiate. They can't play the scene. At the same time, if you have some backlist title that was never going to make its way into audio, maybe that's not a terrible thing to make it available in audio for people who rely on audio. So some novel that was written many years ago, which was not a big novel, it's not going to get a full production from a major company. So why not have it available in audio? And so that's where, it's not really controversial. I think there's a place for AI voices to be used, but I think at the same time that they're not there yet to really take on stuff that requires an actor and a human being's interpretation and performance.
Yeah, what I'm finding here's kind of my take on this. I actually see audio AI audio as being just one version. It's like another product in a way, and it's sort of the way you could offer sort of a discounted version of the audiobook. And I still want to have a human narrated book, But there's in expediency, budget. There's all
Sure.
kinds of reasons why
Right. Well,
you
that's
might not do
exactly
it.
what I was alluding to. Expediency when it comes to things like news is paramount, right? Budget when it comes to, producing an audiobook isn't that expensive in the grand scheme of things,
Yeah.
but it's certainly more expensive if you hire a human and then an editor and all of that. And so, yes, if there's a case where you have a title which is probably not going to sell all that many copies or has been on the shelf for 100 years,
Right.
like, why not use it in that case?
Yeah.
You know, because otherwise it's just not going to get done at all.
Yeah. You are so the in terms of do you feel like you're in competition with AI audio though?
I'm fortunate in that I am probably not in
Yeah.
competition in that I get asked to do things that still require a human. That may
Yeah.
change in 5 years. I would guess that there are people who are working in narration who probably do feel like AI is encroaching on what they do.
Yeah.
And again, you know, I've done this for a long time. I've been somewhat successful at it. And so I'm still getting the things that I don't think a publisher would dream of using AI for. But yes, I do recognize, again, coming back to my point about I'm very aware that this is, you know, encroaching on areas where actors might lose work. It's not affecting me yet. It might someday.
Yeah. Yeah. Same, you know, same as kind of, I have, my feeling is it's just like with writers. I think that
Sure.
there's going to be a shift where, you know, the human writer is their own market. There's
Right.
definitely still going to be
Sure.
just like now, you know, there's the ebook market and then there's the print market, that sort of thing. I think it's going to go that right route.
Well, I mean, you take, you know, you mentioned Stephen King earlier,
Yeah.
like it, I don't know how, look, I'm not particularly well versed in how good AI writing is, but you
Not
know,
great.
it's
Not
not
yet.
great, right? But you know,
It's about like what you were describing with audio, actually.
exactly. You
Yeah.
could say, okay, you know, ChatGPT, write me a Stephen King novel, and maybe it could do a passable job, but it's probably still not a Stephen King novel,
Right.
right? I guess the concern or the thing to keep our eye on for all of us is that this stuff is only going to get better, right? So we're really at the infancy with this. And then, you know, it doesn't scare me so much in that technological shifts have always existed, and we
Right.
as creators and performers have always had to adapt to that, you know. And so some people will probably get left behind, yes. Other people will emerge who might not have been able to do anything before. And this is unfortunately the nature of, you know, the creative marketplace. It's always kind of been that way.
Yeah.
You know, film had an effect on radio, and TV had an effect on film, and talkies had an effect on silent movies, and
Right.
you know, the internet had an effect on network television, and you know, all of this. And so we're constantly adapting to it. So I try not to be too scared by it. I try to think, well, I'll also have to find a way to adapt.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. What it's just, I went to a keynote speech where the guy was talking about AI, and he says, you know, we have a tendency to try to use AI basically the same way we use the technology it replaced, right? But then you have these scenarios where, like, you know, a telephone eliminated the telegraph, but it didn't necessarily. So a lot of those telegraph operators just kind of transitioned into new roles as, you know,
Sure.
telephone operators,
Right.
things like that. But
Sure.
in the meantime, they kept trying to use telephones, you know, early
Right.
phone calls with people would end the call with stop. And then, you know.
Right.
So,
Sure.
you
I
know.
mean, think about what email did to, you know, letter writing and
Right.
the postal service. And, you know, if you're of a certain age, you know, you might bemoan like what's sort of gone missing in your world. But
Yeah.
you do have to understand that, you know, the world is constantly on a forward march. And so it's always going to be changing.
Yeah.
And so that's my optimistic outlook on it is that, you know, we will find ways for people to still be creative and still be able to create things. They'll just
Yeah.
be using different tools.
Do you find though that, because I mean, think about music, you know, vinyl records aren't the greatest quality sound. They're not, you know, they're not easy to store. They're high maintenance, but there's a huge, and there's a new and emerging market now
Yeah.
for that. Do you think maybe that's the kind of thing that's just going to happen all around?
To a degree, yeah. I think my other take on it is that, you know, it may become a narrower sort of usage, right? So maybe first of all, think about what recordings did to live readings,
Yeah.
right? Once upon a time, you had authors quite literally, and now they do book tours where they talk about their books, but they used to literally do tours where they were reading their books, right? I mean, even like you're going all the way back to like Dickens, right? He would
Right.
read his stuff, and Mark Twain would like read his stuff. And now, you know, if they were alive, they would make an audiobook. And so it's just changing it. And so maybe the way, you know, the live reading still exists. I mean, I myself do them from time to time, but they're not as big a thing as they used to be. So maybe this new technology is going to replace something to a degree. It probably won't get rid of it entirely.
Yeah.
It might just become a narrower field.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about we kind of touched on this a little earlier, but when authors are crafting their work, what are some things you think they could do to kind of help with the audiobook process? Like, if you
Right.
could tap an author and say, "Before you get started, buddy,
Yeah.
how about do this and it'll make
Yeah.
everything better?" What would you tell them?
I think your note to them to read their own work aloud first would probably be a good place to start. They might realize they've used the same adjective, you know, five times in a
Yes.
paragraph or something, right?
Yeah.
And that really jumps out when you're listening to it. You know, the funny thing about audiobooks is that let's take a step back. So a book is written without necessarily the intention of it being recorded, right?
Right.
Different from, as we were talking about earlier, a screenplay or a play. Those are expressly written for an actor to come read them aloud, right? To be put on a stage, to be put on a screen. A book is not written expressly to be recorded. Some are. Now, there are some audio-only productions, right? Amazon does a lot of them. Audible does a lot of them. Audible is, of course, an Amazon subsidiary,
Right.
but other people are starting to do them. Spotify is starting to come up with originals, right? So there are things written specifically for audio. So, but the idea of, you know, you take a book, an author writes, they're not thinking, I have to think about the narrator, right? And so it's a bit of a kind of, what's the square peg, round hole
Yeah.
thing, right?
Yeah,
Right.
you got
Okay, there you go. Yeah.
it. Yeah.
So you're kind of shoehorning something in here, which wasn't necessarily intended. And that's okay. You know, I think we as listeners and we as a public are getting used to this idea, especially as audio is just growing and growing and growing and more people are listening. And I
Yeah.
think what is going to happen actually is that authors are going to start naturally kind of moving in this direction. I've heard more and more authors say that, you know, they hear, whether it's my voice or somebody else's voice in their head as they're writing, which I think is fascinating, right? And
Yeah.
so they're thinking, oh, how's this going to sound? How's this going to sound?
Yeah.
Go back to Jess Walter, you know, he said after our collaboration, he was like, all I can do now is like hear my writing as it's going to sound. And I think about like if I had to cast an actor in the role, who would that be? Which he'd said he'd never really considered before
Yeah.
or never really thought of in that way. So I think there's going to be a kind of natural shift in that direction. The only advice I would have, and this is possibly a pet peeve of mine, I think I may have mentioned it earlier, is when you have those 10 characters in the room. You know, it's like,
Yeah.
especially it's like, I'm just going to make up an example. You know, it's like you have a scene in a police station and suddenly you have like five or six
Yeah.
police officers and they
Yeah. Yeah.
all have some dialogue. And I'm
Yeah.
thinking, why? Why do we need five cops in this
I'm going to
scene?
really challenge them and just start throwing in a different accent for each
Oh yeah.
officer and
Right,
all
right, right.
the this guy's got an Irish
Right.
pub
A meeting with 10
and
German generals, right?
this
It's like what do you do there? No, I don't I think writers should keep doing what they're doing. But I do think there'll be this kind of natural kind of blending of these two worlds. And a lot of top authors are being asked to write directly for audio now,
Yes.
which I think is starting to change their mindset.
Yeah,
So,
Spotify reached out to me about doing some things specifically for Spotify.
yeah,
And that's
sure.
got me, it's a different approach. And so I've kind of stumbled a little,
Yeah.
because I know that the point of this is for it to be audio.
Right.
So I'm not,
I
I don't know
am.
if I need to do it the same way I would just for
I mean, you know,
the
what's interesting is I'll throw in an idea here is that if you do go ahead with that you talk to whoever's producing it about who they might want to have actually record it. I mean, if it's you, great. If it's somebody else, to get that person involved in the process as early as possible,
Yeah.
because I think that will change the way
We'll
it
have
comes
them
out.
reach out to you, Eduardo.
Have them reach out to me. I just did something with Spotify. They're wonderful people.
They are wonderful people.
Yeah.
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 I got a lot of good friends who actually work there now. So,
Oh, good.
you've got me thinking now, though, that I'm like, well, wouldn't it be an interesting idea to once the book is ready, finished, my manuscript's done, it's gone through edit, to kind of take that and do an adaptation of it myself, specifically for audio. Do you think something like, I'm not recommending
Wow.
anybody do this. It's the
Right.
kind of suicidal thing that I would do.
Right. This is a bit of a kamikaze mission you're on here. So you'd have two versions. Interesting. So you'd have the print version, and then you'd have the audio version, which maybe would be edited in a way where maybe some of those he said, she
Yeah,
saids are kind of
that's
removed.
what I'm thinking, you know, even
Yeah,
to the
that's an
point of doing
interesting
some
one.
sound design, almost like a performance of the. I mean, I know that people have done this, or I'm not inventing anything necessarily new here,
Right. No,
but
but that's not a, I mean, it's not a terrible idea. The only
yeah.
thing I guess that I've heard does happen is that some people will read and listen at the same time. And so if they have your book in their
See,
hand
that's
or
where
on
I
the.
think you've got an opportunity for two different products. Like you've got
Right, but
the
this might sort
standard
of,
audio.
this might confuse them if they're reading and certain things are not, that they're hearing are not on the page that they're looking at.
No,
But that's.
I'd still want to do the regular
Right,
audiobook, the straight
right.
read, but then have this as like a
Wow.
side
Okay.
option, you know, like
Yeah.
get the
Well,
enhanced audiobook experience. And
this is like the director's cut of the movie,
yeah,
right?
there you
Right.
go. We could even
Ah,
throw in some extra scenes, you know.
interesting.
I'll throw it your way, man.
Sure.
Hey, okay, Eduardo,
Yeah.
go nuts. What
Okay.
happened after this scene? You
And
know,
then we'll
let
need
you.
the writer's commentary on top of the audio as it's
There you go.
happening, right?
That's what we'll do.
That won't be confusing at all,
I kind of
right?
miss the DVD commentaries, honestly. I kind of
Yeah.
miss
Those
doing seeing those.
were a thing for a while. Yeah.
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 So, what do you prefer, man, over with what you're doing? I mean, you're on screen. Do you do stage as well?
I do not do a lot of
Okay.
stage.
Okay.
I never really had that that bug. Some
Yeah.
people love it. I've done some early on. Most of the things I was in were very small, off-Broadway kind of things. And it never quite, held that appeal to me. I always felt like, after a few performances, I was kind of done. And
Really?
so, well, I was
Yeah.
kind of like, we have to do this for 6 more weeks. It's like, what are you
Yeah.
talking about? It was never there for me. So no. What do I prefer? Honestly, I like a mix. I really like the camaraderie that you get on a film set. I like being on location. That's very exciting to me. Go off somewhere for a month to shoot something is a
Right.
fantastic experience. You get to see a whole new place. You get to live there for a while. That's an extraordinary experience. But I also like recording books, and I like the lifestyle that that comes with it. I work at home. I have two school-aged kids. They're 13 and 10. This means that I get to finish my day at 3 when I want to, and
Yeah.
I can hang out with them. So it's great. But I do like a mix. I think all of one or all of the other for me personally would not be the healthiest arrangement.
Yeah. Yeah. I imagine time-wise, it's got to be a little more convenient to do the
Oh,
audiobooks,
of
right? You
course.
can
I mean,
control
you
things.
control. Yeah. I mean,
Yeah.
my audio day usually starts around 8:30, and I usually wrap up around 2:30, and that's a full day for me. Whereas, sure, being on set, you might be called at 5 a.m. and you're out in the middle of God knows where until 2 a.m. and you've shot one page or something, and there's something exciting about that too, but it's very different. That's why I like to go back and forth.
Yeah, what is the timeline usually for you for a book? Because it seems exhausting to me. Like the few times I've done it,
Yeah.
exhausted me.
There's definitely a stamina that is a factor. Figure basically a book is about a week. It's about a week's project. If a book is, say, 300 to 400 pages, with the prep and the recording, and then there's some pickups, some edits that'll happen later. But you're talking about basically a week for a book. So, yeah, a prolific audiobook narrator can be doing 4, maybe even 5 books a month, which means that they could be doing, 50, 60 books a year, which is a lot. But it's a reasonable pace if you think about it. But yeah, the stamina factor is real. I've talked to some wonderful actors who have done a book and they said, never again. I am never doing that. After about an hour in the booth, they were like, I can't. It takes a certain mindset. It takes a certain kind of discipline, and it takes a certain, I almost call it like a Zen-like state where you just kind of get into it and there you are in your quiet booth and it's just you and the book and you just kind of go with it. And then I know to stop when I have sort of lost where I am in the book. I know my brain has checked out at that point. So that's when I stop and I say I'll come back tomorrow.
You start just making scenes up, you
You just
know.
start, yeah, just rewriting the dialogue. Yeah.
All right. Well, we're at time, so we'll go ahead and wrap up, man. But I appreciate you
Oh, this was
chatting
a
with you.
pleasure. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Where can anyone find you online? Anybody
I'm
want
fairly
to?
easily found. Yeah. I mean, there's my website, eduardoballerini.com, which has, the links to all the social handles and all that stuff. Then if people want to see, whatever, all the stuff I've recorded, Audible obviously has it. Libro FM, a site that I'm a big fan of, has it. Spotify has it. And so it's pretty easy to find.
Excellent. We'll see you out there then.
Thanks, man.
So we ranged a lot in the chat and had a good time talking to
Yeah.
Eduardo. But so one of the things he talked about was bringing his acting instincts into the booth and sort of playing the part of the writer. Do you think of like your own writing as a kind of performance?
Yes.
Yeah.
End of sentence.
It's the only way I can explain. The guy yells cut and comes and changes all my clothes.
Yeah, especially since I've started listening to audiobooks. I've been very much thinking about it more. I thought it was really interesting that he keeps an actor or person he knows in his head
Yeah, the
for each
casting
character's
thing.
voice, because I do that when I'm writing. I cast somebody as my character, someone I know, or an actor. So I was like, oh, we just do the same thing, but in a different medium. So I thought that
I'm
was
a
very neat.
fairly visual writer, so like if I can't like kind of hear it and see it, I really struggle with being able to write it, which feels weird because I've written about some interesting things that I haven't personally done, but again, it's just like being able to like visualize it. And I know like for me, one of the steps in my editing is actually reading the entire book out loud to myself. So I think that that also plays a part in it, right? Because you kind of have to be able to, I guess, like you said, like perform in that way, to hear, is this going right? Is this flowing? Is it weird?
I've done some screenwriting in my career, and I think it's been helpful to me to, when I'm writing a scene, even if I'm not explicitly writing stage direction into that scene, for me to know that space, that's been very useful to know the setting and how it plays a part in the story. And the same is true for, I have a pretty good ear for dialogue. And so, you want to avoid going overboard with like dialects and things like that. But, the occasional like throwing in a little bit of dialect just to kind of tell the reader, this is the type of person that you're watching or listening to. Like all those little elements that would go into writing a screenplay are very handy for kind of just, even if it's just sort of subtly shaping how you approach the scene. You don't necessarily have to write all that stuff in there. You don't have to tell the reader exactly what's in the room and how it's arranged, but having a sort of mental map of that, it bleeds through in the way that you write.
Yeah, because I think at some point, ideally, you're writing a book and you want it to eventually have an audiobook, right? And you want it to like maybe get picked up for TV or film rights. And so I think, kind of taking a step back and looking at your story from different perspectives, can only strengthen it because, if you think about like how would they put this scene on TV? Because we've all seen those things. Like Stephen King is notoriously not translated well. the film and TV, like Notorious.
That's because most of his storytelling is highly cerebral. Like
And,
you're
right,
in,
you're
yeah.
in with the character, which
Right.
makes his books really good, right? Because you're in it and you're in that story, and his characters like really shine through.
Yeah.
So it's an, I think it's an interesting exercise, if you're a writer, to look at all of those things and to sort of understand how all those elements play together.
Yeah. So he was not entirely against AI narration, but he did draw a line between like performance and delivery, or just the idea of reading the text aloud versus performing it. So you think that's, does this matter to listeners? Like,
Yes.
where do you think the line should be for writers and publishers on this?
Well, I agree with what Eduardo said. Like, if it's, you can't afford it, and that's the only thing you can do,
Right.
great. Is it a great listener experience? No. Do some listeners care? No. But other listeners do care. I like to hear my work out loud too when I'm
Yeah.
editing. I can't read it myself because I have, tracheal trauma and scar tissue in there. I can't talk that long. Like, I will die. And so I used to have like Microsoft Word read it to me.
Yeah.
And that voice is freaking terrible. Like, it's
Yeah.
so hard to stay focused on it. But now I use one in Google Docs, some plugin, and it's like way, way better. But it's
Yeah.
still not a narrator. Like, a great narrator is worth its weight in gold. I'm talking to you, Jeff Hayes. Good job.
Oh, I
Like,
was just gonna
I
say, yeah.
love a great narrator. I would much rather listen to that.
I don't even think that like AI can replicate like all the different voices, but like once you know that that's one person creating all those voices, like there's just something that's like really you appreciate it more. Like you enjoy it more because like there's like an element of awe almost, like if you're watching like a fantastic character actor, right? Like you can recreate a lot of those things, but when you know it's one person, you're just like, how did that person do that?
I have listened to narrators, and I, in my head, when I'm thinking about those books now, I don't have that person's voice in my head. I have all those characters. And I'm trying to think of a good example of that, but nothing's coming to mind, unfortunately. But a good narrator just disappears in the reading.
Same
And
with an actor, a good
yeah,
actor.
just
Like,
like an actor, right?
anyone else like me and have seen many movies with Gary Oldman in it before you realize it was Gary Oldman? Like, so
Yes.
many.
Oh, there's nothing like when you like watch a movie and you're just like, that part, they're so fam like, where do I know? Like, you've seen them before, but they're so different that like it never would occur to you that they played in a different role.
Yeah, those there are a ton of character actors that are like that. And in fact, there's a whole phenomenon around it. It's called like that guy phenomenon. And so like there'll be people you'll see, you recognize them. I recognize that guy. He used to be on Drew Carey and or whatever. And so I watched a whole video about that recently, like sort of the movie stars versus that guy. And we tend to like the films that feature that guy, we remember those and resonate with those better because they're so familiar to us.
Well, I think that part of it, though, is so part of the magic, I think, of any art is that it removes, how do I want to say this? It almost like removes the specificity of whatever that art is, right? So like a movie, these are now no longer actors on a set. Like you are in that room with people. And I think like paintings do that, and like anything that's like really profound artwork does that. And I think that that's why it becomes so memorable, because it's almost like it becomes personal to you at that point. And the only way you can do that, I think, is by, you have to like erase that distance by, bringing whoever is consuming the art into the piece with you. And I think the only way you can do that is by like erasing all of those distinctions, which.
I think like AI can have its place in audio for sure, but like when I think about it for me as a reader, The narration will make or break if I listen to it. I will stop listening. I think there was a Wheel of Time that was done by a different narrator, and I like had listened to literally 5 minutes, stopped it, and was like, I can't do this narrator. I have to switch. So I had to go find the other one. And like I'm at a state where I'm trying to DNF books or stop reading books faster so that I can find the books that I enjoy. And part of that is the narrator keeping me. And so like for me, my experience, I really like the voice acted, well acted things. I did like what he said though about like fast information, so like news articles, because I would love some of those in more audio format, and realistically they never will be. I think that is like a really fascinating thing that I didn't even think about beforehand, that I'm like, oh, this would be really nice.
Like, you guys are snobs. I'm enjoying listening to Stephen Hawking reads the Harry Potter series.
So with that, up next week. Up next week, it is Orson Scott Card. Orson Scott Card is best known for his science fiction works. As of 2024, he's the only person to have won a Hugo and a Nebula in consecutive years, winning both awards for his novel, Ender's Game, and the sequel, Speaker for the Dead. It's going to be great. Orson Scott Card. So if you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.